COVID-19. It's been another roller coaster week. Hopes of a vaccine by September, then cold water poured on that. Hopes of a V-shaped recovery, only for Rishi Sunak to warn of a permanent scarring to the economy. Schools going back on June the 1st. No, that was never going to be a firm deadline. Meanwhile, things have got even odder in the United States, with just over 5 months to the election. The president once again saying he knows better than doctors and taking an anti-malaria drug to protect him from COVID-19. His predecessor weighed in by saying he doesn't think the present administration knows what it's doing. So huge amounts of uncertainty, but fortunately we have another extraordinary panel to help us make sense of it all. Carolyn Fairbairn is Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, and so is uniquely placed to give her insights into the impact of coronavirus on business. William Hague is the former Foreign Secretary and leader of the Conservative Party. He's now a Teneo Senior Advisor, and he'll be giving his take on how COVID-19 is accelerating trends in politics and economics. Deborah Mathinson was the pollster for Prime Minister Gordon Brown. She now runs the polling and insights company Britain Thinks. And Wolf Pickley, a regular on this call, is Teneo's Director of Research. He'll update us on what's going on around the world. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, once again, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. And let's start with you, Carolyn. The governor of the Bank of England about a week or 10 days ago was saying that we were expecting a V-shaped recovery. Yesterday, Rishi Sunak was much more negative, talking about permanent scarring and more difficulties. Where are you on all of that?
Well, Craig, great to be here with you this morning. Yes, I mean, I am afraid I'm not going to add a tone of great ballooning optimism to this. And actually, I think it's important that we are truly realistic. At the CBI, we've been staying close to all our members, as you can imagine. And I think the truth is, this is just the most devastating wrecking ball for our economy. And I think that it's important that we recognize that it's coming in waves. So, the media, I think, is very good at covering the story of the closures, the real challenge to hospitality and retail. It's all absolutely right that we should cover that. But talking to businesses, we just have the most extraordinary wave of restructuring coming in terms of large and small businesses really thinking about who they can afford to keep on. So you saw Rolls-Royce this morning talking about the 5,000 jobs at risk. I talked to energy companies who are planning redundancies for the autumn. And I think that the thing that we should take great comfort from is that I think in the UK we've got in place a really good set of support measures. The furlough scheme has been great, really worked. We've got 8 million jobs being protected. But you've got global trade projected by the WTO to drop between 12 and 30% this year. These are staggering figures. So I have to say and one member said to me yesterday, we shouldn't be talking about a new normal. We should be talking about a new different and how we have the kind of policy responses that prepare us for something that I have to say, in my judgment, isn't going to be V-shaped, quite what letter of the alphabet it is, but we need some really big policy responses. And for me, one of the really big opportunities, challenges is going to be retraining. How we retrain hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people to work in different industries as we come out of this, as we have this new different, which may have many new businesses, industries. I think digital will be a growth sector. I think sustainable energy will be a growth sector. But these are different skill sets. How we maybe repurpose the apprenticeship levy that has been, a problem from the start, use it in ways that are completely different. But big problems, big solutions. And the more that we recognize this is more than just a cautious, good restart, it's about a restructuring for a new different. And that will take some very big responses.
Thank you, Carolyn. That was a great introduction. I'm going to move to you now, William. On recent calls, you've been talking about how this has accelerated trends in politics and economics. Is that acceleration still happening? And if so, where are we now with it?
Yes, hello. Thank you, Craig. Again, hello to everybody listening to us. Indeed, my argument is that this is a great accelerator. It's slowing down our lives in many ways, and it's slowing down all those things in the economy that Carolyn was just talking about. But it's speeding up many global geopolitical and political trends at the same time. These are the deterioration in relations between the US and China, an existential crisis in the European Union, the arrival of the Pacific century with even greater speed and scale, oil producers getting an early taste of energy transition, much more political interest in problems of inequality, a different political attitude to debt, which I might come on to in the next few minutes. The arrival of state surveillance in a bigger way, and on the positive side, a spur to innovation and invention. So these things are all now pushed along in a great acceleration. You can see this happening on some of these issues on a daily basis. Just in the last week on the deterioration of US-China relations, President Trump has been discouraging an American government pension fund from investing in Chinese equities, bringing into the financial area the split that was already happening in the technological area. And on technology, the US acting against Huawei again, preventing them from buying semiconductors and chips that are made with American equipment. China will probably retaliate against that. Using its list of unreliable entities to which it will add US companies in all probability. So that is, this is not a good thing for the global economy. That is speeding along. You can see the change in foreign policy in microcosm if you look at the World Health Assembly the last 2 days. Some really revealing things. Australia leading the charge for an international investigation into COVID-19. Much resented by China, and China using its wolf warrior diplomacy against that and banning certain imports from Australia and adding massive tariffs to agricultural exports. But then Xi Jinping speaking in a very disarming way to the World Health Assembly, supporting multilateralism in the absence of American support for that, trying to divide the United States from the rest of the world, offering more help to the rest of the world in dealing with the crisis, and blunting and delaying successfully the effort to have an international investigation. And while the United States was left rather in the margins complaining and completely failing to get Taiwan seated in the meeting, there was no real hope of that. So you really see in the way international institutions are working, the changing balance in the world and the effect of the abdication of American leadership in international institutions. I think we're going to see, as the US election hots up, a strong line on China from both sides. Biden is not going to let Trump out-tough him on China. He would have a different approach to global problems like climate change from Trump, which would give hope of greater cooperation with China. But both sides in the US election are going to emphasize how strong they will be on China. And so this scene is likely to continue over the coming months. Just a few words to add on the UK. What Carolyn was saying about training, apprenticeships, and so on, this is going to become extremely important. We are about to see mass unemployment again into millions for the first time since the 1980s. And this will be regarded differently from the 1980s. Of course, it's not morally different, but it will be seen as different. It's not the long-term effect of an inevitable restructuring. It's an accident that's happened to everybody. And there will be an expectation on the business world to participate heavily in the urgent education and training or provision of subsidized employment, whatever it may be, for those people. I think this will be one of the biggest expectations of governments on corporations. So that is coming down the track. And the other thing I want to mention about the situation in the UK, it applies to the US and other economies as well, is this different attitude to debt. People are asking, is this going to lead to big tax rises? Are we in for a new decade of austerity? I can tell you, as someone who served in government in the last 10 years, in the first half of that, when we were implementing austerity, you know, the conservative message was we've got to bring down the budget deficit, control the debt, and so on. The next 10 years will be totally different from that. The Conservative Party isn't going back to austerity. Now, that may be good news in some ways, but it means there is this different approach to debt and maybe inflation. And I do think there can be quite seriously inflationary consequences over the next decade, because we're not going to be paying off or paying down the debts that are being accumulated now. Anyway, lots there to discuss in more detail if people would like to. I'm sorry that's pretty depressing, but happy to discuss those issues further. Thank you.
Thanks, William. No, that was great and fascinating. So that's a real global perspective and lots of accelerating trends. It's good time to come to you, Deborah, because you've been talking to a lot of people about what's going on. You're doing focus groups all the time. I understand that you're getting people to keep diaries. How are you seeing people thinking about this, and are they changing their minds?
Yeah, so it's so interesting against the backdrop that Carolyn and William have set out to think about where the public are. And the answer is that the mood is quite febrile, I think, at the moment. People are quite anxious. They're on a short fuse. 3 out of 10 told us that they're not coping. 42% of 18 to 24-year-olds are not coping. And many more women than men. There's a 10-point difference between women and men. Women are struggling much more with this situation than men are. But what we've seen is that we started off with, I think, almost a quite remarkable unity in the public, with people rallying, I think not rallying around the flag, rallying around the NHS, actually. And we can talk more about that if you want to. I think it's quite interesting why that happened. Favouring lockdown, very pleased. Now divisions are emerging, both in politics and in the country. And the divisions, one dividing line is people who favour sort of safety first and basically don't want to come out again at the moment, and don't want their family to come out again, don't want schools to come back. And then people who actually are itching to sort of get out into the world. And then against that backdrop, politics is back. We've sort of had no politics for a few weeks, and now we do. The government, I think, tipped into net negative ratings for the first time yesterday. And suddenly we're finding in our diaries, people are anecdotally are talking about the government doing much worse. There's a lot of anxiety over the message muddle of a couple of weeks ago. But that said, when you actually look at what the government's doing, there's quite strong support. People were very relieved. They had thought that there was going to be a much heftier, raising of the lockdown, toughness than there eventually was. Sunak is getting a lot of credit. He is coming out quite well. There was a poll yesterday that showed that his positive ratings, he was in net positive 35%. Whereas Boris Johnson is on 7, Matt Hancock, by contrast, is taking the hit for all the the PPE shortages, the care home problems and so on. He's on -1, Raab on -3, and Priti Patel on -34. What we're hearing anecdotally is growing concern about Boris Johnson. There's a sense, I think, that different leadership is needed in different times. And people for the first time are looking at him and thinking, is he the right guy to lead us through this? Is he across the detail? And I think, Keir Starmer's arrival on the scene has shone a bit of a light on that and has been quite tricky for Boris Johnson to navigate, most notably at PMQs, but across the piece. I think there are a lot of other organisations that are under scrutiny as well. It's not just government. So people are taking a big financial hit already and they don't know what's coming around the corner. But they're looking at organisations, businesses, for example, and wondering how they're going to cope. And they're judging them in three ways. They're judging them on how they look after their staff, they're judging them on how they look after their customers, and they're judging them on their ability to grasp the nettle and become part of the sort of wider solution. So are you prepared to be flexible and say, we can now manufacture PPE, even though we used to manufacture something quite different? They're looking at that, but also a bit of a note here, they are very wary of tokenism. One person in one of our diaries last week wrote, giving free stuff to NHS workers is frankly a bit trite. And they're also very cautious about what they call cloying communications. So one person said, I am so sick of companies starting their ads with now more than ever. So I think there's some quite interesting thoughts about messaging there. And finally, I mean, I sort of wanted to end on a positive note too, this new normal. Only 9% want us to go back to normal, which I think is really interesting. Normal was not a good place to be, and they do want something different. And they're looking forward, and I think they will judge all the key players on the plans they make for the future. And 47% of people in our poll say that they think we can change for the better, and they want us to change for the better. And one person in our diaries last week said, the worst outcome is that we don't learn anything and life goes back to normal. So again, quick whistle stop tour through public opinion, but happy to come back and pick through any of those.
That was fascinating, really interesting point to end on, essentially that a theme is developing here, isn't there? The difference between normal and the new reality or the new difference. Wolf, let's just end with you. Lots of news this week about different countries easing lockdown, coming out of it, and the pain and difficulties they're experiencing with that. Are any of them doing with it any success, or is it just as problematic as it's being reported in the media?
I would say early days, but certainly fairly problematic. So I will be looking mainly at continental Europe here. Why is problematic? Well, as Deborah mentioned, politics is back, and is across the board. Macron is down at 40% again after reaching 55% at the beginning of the crisis. Even Merkel, she's managed the crisis fairly well, the last month has lost 5% of support. In Spain, there are protests against the government of Sanchez, even happening today because there is a new decree coming. And the same story in Italy. So politics is back, is going back to its confrontational kind of normal status. That's one issue, and that is clearly, at the same time, the government are facing this growing pressure to accelerate the reopening, and we have seen that acceleration happening with guidelines given and then being changed in due course in Italy, in Greece, and so on. So the pressure is there. On the political front, what is also interesting for us to see is that center-right voters are generally more aggressive about reopening in comparison to the other side of the political spectrum. The problem is that even center-right governments are struggling to deliver on this, because when you look at the majority of the public, they remain fairly uneasy about fast reopening across the board there. One debate which is emerging, and that is somewhat connected to what Lord Hagen mentioned, is taxation. Austerity, nobody wants to talk about austerity, but the debate about taxation is emerging on the political front, because at some point governments will have to reduce the debt to GDP ratio. Which kind of taxes are we talking about? Wealth tax, digital tax, windfall tax. This debate are already happening in France, in Spain, and in Italy. So we should expect that kind of debate to become more intense when the impact of the crisis will become even more manifest, and the shock absorber that we have now in place will be over. The reopening is moving very slowly. We look at Austria and Germany, generally considered as having managed the crisis fairly well. The public is out, but is still very wary. And I think here, what is also damping a bit the will of the consumer to spend is that economic concerns are coming back on the agenda, because the health crisis, it feels somewhat kind of managed. And there are continuous bad news in terms of restructuring, as Caroline mentioned. You know, when we look at Europe, yesterday the largest department store has announced that it's cutting 50% of its shops. Renault is shutting down 3 plants in France. So it's difficult for consumers here to go back to the good old days when you have this continuous news about people potentially facing unemployment. The complexity of the guidelines is a huge nightmare for business. It's across the board. pages and pages of guidelines that is increasingly difficult to implement. At times, you cannot even find the material you need. Guidelines which are different from one location to the other in the same country, in the same region, at times in the same province, depending how you manage this reopening here. So that is becoming a huge issue. The other one that is emerging is the liability of employers. In the sense, if a worker catch coronavirus at work, who is liable for that? In some countries, that is a criminal offense. That is becoming an issue. It's initially in Italy, the guidelines were poorly drafted. The equivalent of the CBI, Confindustria, reacted. They tried to provide some explanation around it, but the issue is there and is likely to become more predominant once we start seeing some workers, unfortunately, getting infected. Final point, which I think is also interesting here, we are accelerating the opening. There are going to be more pressure to reopen the borders to save the touristic season. The reality here is that nowhere in continental Europe, and certainly not in the UK as well, we have a robust system of testing, tracing, and tracking. Nowhere, not even in Germany at this point here. What is also interesting about this is that we've heard so much about the app. The app is already losing, is already no longer in fashion. First, it's extremely controversial. Macron has been forced to give away a non-binding vote in parliament because of the concerns about privacy of the app. In Italy, we are supposed to have a vote. We don't know when about that. But on top of this, people are saying, well, if it's not compulsory, not many people will adopt it. It's not particularly efficient. Why we don't go for human tracing? So human tracing has suddenly become a bit more fashionable, if I can use the term, than the app. How they're doing human tracing is quite interesting as well. So in Greece, they deployed 150 police inspectors to do that. Obviously, Greece, small countries, very few cases. In Italy, they are hiring 16,000 people. We don't know when. How can you hire people in current conditions is unclear. As a state, you are supposed to have a competition and so on. In Germany, is a country where actually they are doing it fairly well. In our view, they are able to track and trace fairly quickly, and they've done it already in a couple of cases because it is at the municipal level that the health authorities are doing this. So they are able to go in very, very quickly and then to implement whatever is needed equally quickly. That seems to be the formula that somewhat works better when we compare to some of the other countries in Europe. And let me stop it there and thank you again.
Thank you, Wolf. That was great. I'm just going to remind people that if they drag their cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, that they can put some questions in there. We're already getting a couple coming through. But I want to start on the economics of this, and particularly with Carolyn and William. The big thing that's sort of punching through is the scale of the debt, and then also the issue of how is it going to be taxed to bring it down. William, you were part of an administration that said that you can't sustain levels of debt that were much less than this. How is it that we are now have this magic money tree and seem to be able to treat it okay? Is it actually going to just have to be dealt with through taxation? And Carolyn, where do you think business should stand on the scale of the debt and taxation? But come to you first, William.
Well, there is a difference, of course. It's not just that it feels politically different. There is an actual difference, which is that in the financial crisis, some countries borrowed much more heavily than others. And the UK in particular, bailing out banks, went up to had a big increase in national debt and budget deficit that went up to 12% of GDP. And so there was a genuine argument that it was necessary for international credibility to restore the UK's finances, to bring that deficit right down again, which is what has happened over the last 10 years. Now, in this situation, of course, everybody is in the same boat, really. Central banks all over the world are creating money on a vast scale. And really on too big a scale for anybody to contemplate repaying that debt in the near future. So partly here, it's the effect of it being a much more a global problem for government budgets. And partly it's just the effect of scale, you know, that a politician who needs to find £10 billion will raise the taxes to find it, but the one who needs to find £200 billion is not even going to look for the £10 billion and take all the pain of that. So I'm not saying there won't be any tax increases, and Wolf is quite right about the debate starting about this, and there will be stronger advocacy of taxation of wealth and land and corporations, and the Treasury will dust down all the favourite schemes it has, for instance, for changing taxation of the self-employed in the UK, and bring them out again if it can, in order to raise more revenue. So I'm not saying there won't be any tax rises, but I am saying that it's a scale of debt that no one is going to try and repay in this generation. Look at the EU proposals for the 500 billion euro fiscal help that Merkel and Macron just unveiled involve raising money that will be repaid maybe in the 2060s. So this is the time horizon. What does this mean? I haven't gone too long. It means governments will have a big vested interest for the next generation in keeping ultra low interest rates and having moderate inflation that that over time reduces that debt. And I think in that situation, central banks are going to find they are less independent. You know, central banks will be independent in the same way Russia is democratic. That is, officially they are, but not really. So I think that is what's coming.
Okay. Carolyn, are you comfortable about this scale of debt and the fact that it's going to be paid off in the next generation? How does business feel about that?
Yeah, so Craig, I'd say I agree with a lot of what William just said. This is different from anything we have seen before, and we need to think about it differently. And one of the biggest differences is this is a total demand shock. So, you know, we've got consumers spending between 20 and 40% less, depending on which kind of survey you read. The biggest priority, a lot of this is about phasing, the biggest priority for the coming year, in my view, in the view of business, is growth. We have to be relentlessly focused on growth. Every bridge to growth that we can find, including trade, we will probably need to see stimulus to the automotive sector, to travel, we need to get growth going. And then next year, I think we can begin that conversation about how it's paid for, because one of the things we don't know yet is who the winners and losers are going to be. It's all very well to talk about wealth tax and windfall tax. We don't know, you know, who should be taxed yet, because this has to run through the system. So I think the business point of view on this would be growth is the priority for the coming 12 months. That is a conversation that we can have. I think absolutely the priority, you know, keeping interest rates low, taking our time over this. But if we don't still try and minimize that scarring, get the retraining, I think we might need to have a big investment program on workfare, on that kind of helping businesses to support people in the right new sectors. This is all going to cost money. We need growth. Let's save that conversation around how we pay for it for next year.
So, but this theme of, just sticking with you, Carolyn, this theme of wealth tax is coming through Yvonne Hills, for example, and some of the questions are coming through. Are you averse to that as an idea, or thinking that you can soak businesses as well?
I think we will need to think about all of these taxes. I mean, I think wealth tax has been an interesting idea that has been running through the economics of our, you know, economic thinking for a while now, you know, Piketty to others. And I suspect that we will have to go in that direction. But I think we need to be incredibly careful at the moment about raising taxes on business or consumers, because we have to get growth. You know, if we are looking at a 14% contraction in our economy this year, that is devastating. We, you know, that's more than four, you know, that's four times, three to four times the financial crash. If we don't, this is about timing. It's about what matters most when. A wealth tax might come into the mix, but I wouldn't be thinking about it this year.
Thank you. I'm interested, Deborah, in this thing that you were talking about, that there's a kind of new divide that's going on in between those who are willing to be a bit more gung-ho going out there and those who are frankly frightened of it. How is that divide breaking down? Are we seeing it as a completely different new thing, or is it Remainers versus Leavers, left versus right? Is that split forming a pattern that's traditional?
It's age more than anything else. It's younger people who are itching to get out, and older people who are frankly more scared and wanting to stay inside and wanting their kids to stay inside. And I think there's a gender difference here as well. Men, interestingly, I don't know what the men in the audience think about this, but men are more likely to be to have been kind of breaking the lockdown guidelines than women, and talking about that fairly openly. Women are much more cautious and much more protective of their families, you know, the older people in their families, the kids in their families and so on. So, you know, those divides are not along any kind of political line, and they don't particularly relate to the economy either. I was thinking, as both William and Carolyn were talking just now, that the very gloomy scenario that they are painting, you know, gloomy but obviously realistic at the moment, and I think this is quite scary, is something that is passing a lot of the public by. They're not thinking that far ahead. They really genuinely have no particular thought beyond getting through the day to day. I mean, some people are already badly affected, have lost their jobs or are furloughed on a fraction of their wages or whatever, and they're managing that situation and not thinking about what's coming next. They are assuming that it will get better straight away, not that it's going to get worse, I think. So that's going to be a very careful, there's a careful piece of expectation management to go on here.
No, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because it's very clear that most people understand the health implications, but have they understood what's coming economically? And
I think they really haven't.
And that's going to be a fascinating challenge for the government. I want to bring this around, talking about challenges. I woke up this morning and realised that, you know, the US election is only about just over 5 months away, Wolf and William. It really is extraordinary to think that is actually quite a short period of time, and you know, we would normally expect it to be much more framed clearly at this time. Where are we going with this? Is Trump in trouble? Let's start with you, Wolf.
Looking at the numbers, I was looking at you this morning, so the approval of rate of Trump at this point is 43.6. If you want to look at a precedent that was lower than this in the current cycle, you have to go back to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was down at 39% at this point of the cycle. Having said that, what Trump is trying to do now is to frame himself as the guy that wants to do things. He wants to reopen the economy. He doesn't want to talk about the coronavirus, obviously. So it's about opening the economy and blaming the Democrats for being lazy, attacking Pelosi because the U.S. House of Representatives has been in recess for 2 months now, whereas the Republican-controlled Senate has been in session for the last 2 weeks, attacking governors from the Democratic Party or independents who are not willing to open. And he's actually campaigning. He's visiting the key battleground states in Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Biden is doing virtual campaign from his basement. What is there to monitor for us? Are they going to be able to reopen the schools in late August, September? Question mark. If they are able to do that, it's good for Trump. We still don't know whether Democrats will have their big conference in August. It's still unclear. The real campaign here is that the campaign is going to be a virtual campaign for most of the summer. The real campaign will be super compressed between September and October. And that will likely make the TV debates more important than usually they are. And there, Biden will struggle against somebody who knows how to use TV as Trump. What can derail the world Trump strategy? A second wave. If there is a second wave, all the strategy of Trump goes into the bin. That is where we are at this point, in my view.
So William, we've seen a lot of Trump for obvious reasons, not very much of Biden, but quite a bit of Obama. Do you think that's deliberate?
Yes, I think so. I think that would be coordinated with the Biden camp. I don't think a former president of the same party would, wade in without consultation with the nominee. It is difficult for Biden to get attention, where, you know, when he is, as Wolf says, sitting in his basement. And so Obama contributing to the criticism of Trump will be a coordinated part of helping the Democrat campaign. I think Trump is in trouble, to answer your original question, that the, you know, you won't be able to write him off until election day, and don't bet heavily on the outcome of an American election. It is going to be close, whatever happens. But there are two big factors here. One is what you were just discussing with Deborah. People don't realize what the scale of what's about to happen next. And that will be very difficult for incumbent governments when it happens. And the second is that he's in trouble anyway, when you look at the what's going on in individual districts and states in America. Anybody who's analyzed the elections in Wisconsin recently, a key swing state that held elections, for instance, to elect a new Supreme Court judge in the state, that looked pretty grim if you were running the Trump campaign. So don't make any assumption he's going to be re-elected.
Okay. Karen, we're getting a few sort of points about liability for coronavirus. Whereas people are going to start coming back to work, people are genuinely saying that business should be worried about the possibility of corporate manslaughter. It feels a bit ridiculous, but is that really true? And are you worried about that?
It's a very big live issue for business, because it's actually not clear where the legal liabilities are at the moment. The guidance that's come out from Bayes, actually very good guidance in general for eight different kinds of workplaces, is only that, it's guidance. Existing, you know, 1974 Health and Safety Act, all of that applies. And the corporate manslaughter potential is absolutely live as well. I think what we draw real reassurance from, though, is that we do have 60% of the economy that is open and that has been dealing with creating safe workplaces now for the last 2 months. And actually what they're reporting back to us is that with the right kind of collaboration with unions, with, you know, really smart use of, you know, perspex, staggered work shifts, red and blue teams, PPE where necessary, actually they are able to, they feel confident that the legal risk they feel is manageable. But I know this is a live issue across Europe, and it's very interesting to hear Wolfgang's points on that. I think we do need more clarity on this from government, so that for some businesses, it isn't a chill factor that actually stops their employees coming back and actually stops them from reopening.
Deborah, is that coming through in your research, a concern about going back to work and potentially dying as a result of it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, people are more frightened than they are wanting to get out and to get back. And I mean, particularly, I think people that live in cities, because it's not just about the workplace, actually, although that's incredibly important, but it's also about how you get to work. So, you know, the people, our diarists who live in London, for example, do not want to get on the tube anytime soon.
And let's just shift it back to the macro politics of it all. You're saying that Boris Johnson has actually had positive ratings for quite a long time, but that seems to be turning. Do you expect that to plummet, or is it just too volatile to tell?
I think it's too volatile to tell. I think a lot will depend on what happens with Keir Starmer. But I think that, you know, Boris Johnson enjoyed, as all new prime ministers do, something of a honeymoon almost immediately afterwards, and people that had felt doubtful about him. So we found before the election, he divided people, and the dividing lines there were Leave Remain more than anything else. So if you were a Leave voter, you thought he was a fantastic sort of heroic champion of yours. And if you were a Remain voter, you were much more sceptical. We then found people coming together around him. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in the Red Wall seats because I've been interested there. I'm writing a book about voters there. And there they were, you know, they really felt that he was one of them, that he really spoke for them in a way that most politicians haven't done. So fantastic warmth towards him. And I think people are looking at him now again with fresh eyes and thinking, is he the right guy? The other thing that's interesting is people are feeling he's rather invisible as well. You know, so they obviously, he's been ill, they know that, he's had a baby, they know that, but they feel we're in a national crisis and they don't feel they're seeing as much of him as they would like to be seeing.
Yeah, no leadership.
I'm interested in William, you having been a former leader of the opposition and experience becoming leader of the opposition, how are you viewing Keir Starmer in the light of that?
Well, I think Keir Starmer is playing it skillfully. You know, he is approaching it forensically at prime minister's questions and without setting out an alternative plan. He's not taking big political risks in saying do things very differently. He's questioning the government, building up his credibility. You know, he's trying to look like a reasonable, responsible guy, obviously in contrast with how people regarded his predecessor. And that's a relatively easy task for him. It will get much more difficult, of course, when people expect some different plan for the future to be set out. But then he will have the advantage of we're in an entirely new situation with all these different new political issues about inequality and unemployment and how we treat debt and taxation, the things we've been mentioning earlier. So for an opposition, that gives much more scope than if they were just trying to recover from the general election of last December. So I think he's had a good start from the Labour Party's point of view.
Good. Carolyn, there's a fair bit coming through. This is a sort of typical question from Matthew Reed, who's from Marie Curie. In the discombobulation within the UK, the shock to the social contract and praise for NHS care and other low-paid key workers, how will we come to understand society and social capital in the new different? I mean, I suppose what a lot of other people are also getting to is businesses having to think differently. So, for example, ESG was number one before this, but now purpose driving right through. Has that changed? New social contract. Where is business in all of this?
Well, I think this is a potential real turning point where I think your profit with purpose has obviously been a big conversation for years now. But this is a moment where I think business is able. I speak to so many leaders who are really trying to step up and show how their business can make a huge difference. And Deborah, you know, really interesting, this idea of purpose sprinkling and skepticism around that. I think a lot of leaders are really sensitive to that. So there was just one example I was going to give to Deborah earlier on, which is, you know, one construction company I was talking to actually does information packs and briefing for the families of their workers because they really understand how important that confidence to let your let your loved one go to work in the morning.
Brilliant.
And these are kind of real things. And I think there is something really about understanding the value of the individual and employees as people that has come through. You know, it's Mental Health Awareness Week. And I've been so struck by how many businesses are really making a huge deal of this in providing extra support for their employees. And I think that we might see something actually really meaningful around what purpose means in all of this, way beyond, you know, hand sanitizers and all of that, but just how we do build back better. I think sustainability actually is going to go up the agenda. It fell off the agenda after the financial crisis. That's not what I'm hearing now. I'm hearing it go right up because it's what consumers want and it's how people want to see the economy rebuilt. I think how we use what we're seeing around levelling up, you know, if people don't have to commute in the same way, will some of that kind of urbanisation that we've seen can we actually rebuild some communities around the country because people don't have to travel to work in the same way because businesses make it possible for them to work from home. So I have to say, I think there are an awful lot of challenges, but I think there are real opportunities here now in the way that business shows what it can do.
Just to follow up on that point though, so that, yes, people, we are also talking about a situation where lots of people aren't aware of the economic impact. That's one of the themes we've talked about. So we're saying that sustainability is still going to be a massive thing and ESG is going to still be a massive thing. This week it emerged there are 10 million people in the UK who are effectively on a furlough scheme. Many of those people do not have jobs. We're expecting that the second quarter, that not just an average of 50,000 added to unemployment, but hundreds of thousands added to unemployment. Is it really the case that people are going to be valuing ESG and sustainability as much as they did in that economic reality? So let's, Carolyn, very quickly from you, and then let's go to William.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm the first one. I think we will see mass unemployment. The US has 36 million people claiming benefits at the moment. So I completely agree. But if you think about some of the opportunities here, give you an example. We know that we need to refit 26 million boilers in houses to move them away from gas, to make them sustainable. What better time now to make that, you know, if we're going to have people who haven't got, they're losing their jobs, why not make this a national effort that we do upgrade those boilers? I think the same is true in terms of building out our digital infrastructure. Why not do that in a sustainable way? What better time when the roads are quiet and we have telcos with deep pockets who can do that? And that keeps traffic off the road. So, I mean, I think if we think about this differently, we can create jobs in these new sectors. And I think a lot of companies are thinking about how they can support that.
William, ESG still massively as important as it was before?
Yes, I think so. I very much take the point you're asking about, Craig, that when people are trying to get their livelihoods back and get businesses just going again at all, can this be a priority? And that is bound to exert some drag the other way. But overall, I agree with Carolyn, and I think there will be the same feeling in the political world. You know, we saw from the government's advisory committee on climate change a couple of weeks ago a report which basically said, you know, it said many things, but one of its headlines was take some of the money that we were going to invest in roads over the next 20 years and put it into our digital infrastructure, because you can see how people are going to be adapting to that different world. And I think there will instinctively be a lot of support for that, and that could chime in with the determination of business leaders to use this as the way to recover. So overall, I think that will happen, but obviously not in every business, maybe not in every sector, but overall, yes.
So, and just quickly, Deborah, is that something you're seeing cutting through from the focus groups and the diaries that you're...
No, I mean, you know, caveat this with, as I said earlier, people are not yet aware of what's hurtling towards them. They really are not on the whole aware of that. And there's a need for some honesty, transparency, for somebody to set out a very clear vision, picking up on these things. If you ask people now what's the change they want to see, it comes back to a different kind of public spending. 87% in a poll that we did a couple of weeks ago said the thing they want to see more than anything is health workers and carers to be properly valued. Now that means a very different kind of public spending, and you know, who knows if there's going to be the money available for it, but a politician that decides not to do that is, I think, taking quite a big risk in terms of their popularity.
Okay. Wolf, I'm...
Can I come in?
Yes,
please. I think there is another angle on this. There is a state angle in the sense that as a result of the crisis, the state will play a bigger role in the economy for the foreseeable future across the board. And already now, even in the UK, when we look at the condition attached by the government in exchange for the credit guarantees, the loans and so on, there are some ESG measures there. They might not be the like that necessarily we like, but no buybacks, no payment of dividends, compensation of executive being discussed. Macron made very clear to Air France that they get a bailout if they make their fleet greener. So there is an angle coming from, there is a bottom-up approach, but also there is a top-down approach here, which I think it could become more dominant as business would have to rely more on governments in terms of bailout and regulatory changes and so on. So that is one area to keep an eye on.
Okay. Wolf, there's one thing that's coming through, and certainly every time I pick up a newspaper or look at a website, there's an article about whether or not we're going to be able to go on holiday. And then when you actually read the article, the answer seems to be no, but they still raise the prospect. What is the truth of that?
It's too early to say. We should forget about an EU deal on this. Everybody was going to do it in its own, like they did the lockdown. bilateral deals, air bridges, like they were suggested here. Complicated for the airlines to put together a schedule based on air bridges. So I think it's still far too early to say. I can tell you what they are doing now in Greece, for example, a country where tourism is almost, what, 40% of GDP without counting the black economy. Well, if you arrive in Athens today, they will do you a test at the airport. They will take you to a designated hotel. You wait 24 hours there until you get the test result back. If it is clean, you can go, but you are still supposed to self-quarantine yourself for 2 weeks. The Greeks can do it now because I guess there are 300 arrivals per day in Athens. When there are 30,000 arrivals per day, doing it in 24 hours becomes a bit more complicated. In Hong Kong, they keep you for 8 hours at the airport right now. So far too early to say, frankly, especially in an environment where, as I was saying before, no country has in place a robust test, tracing, tracking system, and system that they actually will need to talk to each other. We are far, far away from there.
Question here from Laura Flynn. On the subject of taxes, it's been widely reported that the PM has had a change of heart on tackling obesity and will be much more interventionist, with some speculating a sugar tax is on the menu. Given the links between obesity and higher fatalities, do you think it's likely that an extension of the sugar tax could be announced in an emergency budget? And what would we think of that? Deborah, let's start with you on that. Do you think people would actually welcome that because they're realizing that, as Boris put it, you can't be fat in your 50s?
I think it would feel like quite a little thing at the moment, a sugar tax. I mean, it would feel like quite a little intervention when they're looking for much bigger statements. I think people just might think it was quite odd if that became, you know, very center stage. Would they mind? I think historically there's been reasonable amounts of support for that, actually. But I think it's quite a long way from the thing that people are worried about. I was thinking when you were talking about holidays as well, if I can just go back to that, it's interesting because we asked people what they missed most at the moment, and it wasn't going on holiday. I mean, for women, it was quite simply seeing their family and friends. And for men, it was going to the pub. And they'd rather do those things, yes. Aren't they great?
Okay, we're coming towards the end of the session. It's been fascinating. And there's one question that I think will probably pull it all together. Sally Osman is asking, does the panel think we currently have enough new different leadership capabilities in business and in politics in the UK or globally to adapt and tackle these enormous issues, let alone communicate clearly and honestly? So that's a massive question. So I'm going to go around the panel, and I'm going to start with you, Karen. Are we actually seeing people realizing that they have to be different in the way that they lead? Are we actually seeing any sign of that? Is there any optimism there?
Well, I'd like to be actually reasonably optimistic on that, I think. I think it is, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man or woman. And you are seeing, I think you're seeing in a number of walks of life, I think certainly in business, people standing up and being counted. You know, whether it's, you know, Dyson on ventilators, or, you know, the supermarket heads sort of talking about how they're, you know, the fifth emergency service in keeping food out there. I think you are seeing new leadership. I think you're also seeing a lot of, you know, leaders challenging how they do it because it's really hard. But I actually think that we are going to see it. And, you know, politics, we'll have to wait and see. We hope so.
William, do you think we don't seem to be having much global leadership in general? Lots of countries doing whatever they think is right for them individually. Are you seeing any signs of differences in leadership or improved ways of meeting the new world?
Not much on the global scene, no. I mean, you wouldn't be able to say that about President of the United States or the President of China, or no. But again, I think we should have a bit of optimism here. New circumstances, as Caroline says, do bring forward new people. And perhaps this will lead to a change in opinion globally about the obvious need to tackle global problems together. And that might encourage people to elect leaders who are amenable to that. Now, this is like the very optimistic end of the scale. But I think we have to, those of us who believe in globalism, not nationalism, have to have some hope that that will happen.
Wolf?
I will try to be optimistic following William Lee here. I think the anti-globalization leaders are not having a good crisis. So maybe there is a silver lining there. The Bolsonaro, the Erdogan, even the Modi of this world, the Donald Trump, they haven't handled it that well. Even a populist in opposition, they're currently in opposition, they've not been able to exploit the crisis to increase their ratings. So maybe there is some hope on that front.
Okay, and Deborah.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to be, the thing I found most depressing throughout all of this is the lack of global leadership. And I think businesses have done it much better than politicians. In the short term, success has been about being nimble and flexible, hasn't it? But I think in the longer term, what we're going to need is much more planning. It's hard for politicians and to a certain extent for businesses to do the sort of long-term planning that's necessary. But I think that's what we're going to need. But, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Maybe we can pull it off. Francis O'Grady, who I think spoke at one of these events a couple of weeks ago, was saying something yesterday about pulling together a special team of people who would advise on long-term planning. And I think that's the kind of thing that's needed locally and globally.
Thank you. Well, we've come to the end of this Teneo Insights call. I just wanted to say one piece of parish notice. Next week, we're going to have the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, the economist Jim O'Neill. He's got some fascinating things to say about it, so tune in for that. But in the meantime, I want to say thank you to a brilliant panel, Carolyn Fairbairn, William Hague, Wolf Pickley and Deborah Mattinson. It was fascinating, really appreciated it, and lots of food for thought. So thank you and have a good week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.